Hi, everybody. Welcome to the 10th annual Boston Book Festival. It's really exciting, and I'm really pleased to welcome Stephanie and Ryan to give their talk. There will be about 45 minutes of discussion, and then if you have any questions, we'll have an audience question session at the end. So save your questions. And afterwards, both of their books are for sale in the hallway outside, and then they'll be doing a signing in the room just to the left of the stairs that you just came up to be here. So if you could just join me in giving them a warm welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Stephanie. This is Ryan.
Hello.
We've been tasked with, I'm supposed to introduce both of us, and then Ryan and I are going to talk about some of Ryan's many amazing projects, but not all of them. And after I ask Ryan some questions, you will get the chance to ask Ryan your own questions. But I've been told to tell you who I am, although there's no reason you should care, because we're here because Ryan writes amazing things. My name's Stephanie Burt. I write books of poetry. I write books about how to read poetry. I write like articles and essays about how to read comics and books with mutants and spaceships and magic in them and queer people, ideally all of those things at the same time. And I teach at an old college across the river. There are a couple of those. And we are here to think about the amazing things that Ryan North has done. And it's a set of things that wouldn't haven't come together very often, but they come together in his life. He has graduate and undergrad degrees in computer science from Carleton and the University of Toronto in Ontario, and has used them to do what people who get degrees in CS normally do, which is to write comic books, wrote a number of different scripts, including some runs of Adventure Time, the comic based on the TV series that just ended, and a super popular webcomic that I know a lot of people, maybe some of you, start your day with, called Dinosaur Comics, which is what it says on the tin. It's dinosaurs talking about everything. And went on from there to become the scriptwriter and co-creator of the greatest all-ages comic series of all time, The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl.
Thank you.
And in some sense, all of us are Squirrel Girl for Halloween. And in some other sense, only the very best grade schoolers are that. And so we are going to ask some questions about Koi Boy and Fish Miss and Bass Lass and alternate time travel versions of ourselves and trips to the Savage Land and Doombots and stuff. And Latveria. We got to get to Latveria.
Yes.
But we're going to start by asking about Ryan's latest project, which is not comics. It is Ryan's second full-length book. I want to say that's not comics, except there's kind of comics in them, depending on...
Yeah. I haven't written a straight prose novel. I just do crazy stuff. This is my first nonfiction book, although it has a fictional candy coating around it.
Wait, you mean Squirrel Girl isn't real?
Squirrel Girl is a documentary comic series.
Okay, that explains a lot. Yes. But no, it's Ryan's first book that is openly presented as nonfiction, and it is called How to Invent Everything. And I'll give you the setup, so you don't have to explain that, and then we can just start talking.
Sure, yeah.
It is a book about how to invent all of the stuff that you would need to restart civilization if you became stuck in the Paleolithic.
Or any other time period.
Well, except if you're stuck long enough ago, it just says, this isn't going to work for you, give up, there's
yeah.
no oxygen in the atmosphere.
If you're back before the Big Bang, you've escaped the scope of the book. If you're on Earth before there's oxygen, you're going to have a short time.
Right. But a lot of it's about like collaborating with other people and feeding them. Like, you're not going to build farming if it's just you.
Yeah, if you're there before there's humans or proto-humans, you're pretty much just building a civilization to pass the time for yourself. Because there's no one else in it.
Yeah. But the premise of the book is that it's a time machine manual.
Yeah.
And you read about how to use a time machine and how to avoid, you know, meeting yourself and going back and changing the results of one or another election, as tempting as that can be these days. And then what do you do if your time machine malfunctions and it looks like the manual that came in your car if you drive a car? And if not, great, you don't need one in Boston. And then you get to the page that says, you know, here's what to do if it's failed. I'm going to read it aloud. In the event of a catastrophic failure of your FC3000 time machine, please refer to the convenient repair guide which follows this page and makes up the bulk of this volume. Repair guide. There are no user serviceable parts inside the FC3000. The FC3000 cannot be repaired. Oh. It's just so beautifully constructed.
Thank you.
Yes, this is a problem. If you are reading this repair guide, you will not be returning to the future. And then you learn how to invent language, spoken language, written language, non-sucky numbers, numbers that do not suck. Roman numerals, for example, suck really hard. Hindu-Arabic numerals are much better.
Better, yeah.
And then eventually you get things like mining and like crop rotation and first-generation antibiotics. And then eventually, of course, computer science.
Yeah.
And then
you
you're done.
Build computational machinery, and then you're off to a good start.
And then you invent Squirrel Girl, and you're done.
And you're done.
I mean, one could say that actually you're done when you invent Koi Boy, and you're not done until then. So are you tired of being asked where the idea for this came from?
No, I love it, because I think we have this idea around authors that they're really smart, smarter than the rest of us. And people have asked me, like, how did you write this book? Like, you just had all this stuff in your head. And I love that idea. Like, it presupposed I didn't have to do any research. I just wrote down all my brilliant ideas in about half
there
an hour.
There is, thank God, the trade publishers allowed Ryan to provide an index and a bibliography to work a popular nonfiction. If you're a trade publisher, like, take note.
Well, the reason we put that in is that it's a weird book in that it's wrapped in this, the time travel part is fictional so far, but the instructions are nonfiction, and my publisher was worried because she was thinking, like, we're worried people are going to file this in nonfiction, or they're going to think it's all made up. And so the bibliography shows, like, this Squirrel Girl guy did his research. This guy, here's some stuff to learn more. So it gives it a weight of a research paper while still being a fun time travel manual. So to answer the question, I had the idea because I saw Back to the Future when I was a kid, and I was maybe 6 years old, and I think it was my first exposure to the idea of time travel, and I was just, I spent the next 10 years thinking about it, just fascinated by this idea of going back and fixing things and changing things. And I think if you, once you get out of like the past 30 years where you kind of know, you know, lottery numbers might be useful or stuff like that, once you get out, you know, 50, 60, 100, 1,000 years in the past, and you interrogate that fantasy carefully, you kind of, at least I realized, like, I'd be a really sucky time traveler. Because I would go back to the year, like, 1000 BC and say, hey, guys, the future's great. We've got soap. We've got antibiotics. We've got computers. And they'd say, great, how do you make that? And I'd be like, I don't know. But they're going to be great when you get there. And I had this, I don't want to call it a concern, but it kind of was a concern that I would be a sucky time traveler. I would go back in time and be useless. And so part of the motivation, and it's a ludicrous motivation, but part of the motivation to write this book was to make myself a more competent time traveler. And the side effect is that it also made me, and hopefully you, the readers, more competent people in our world. Like, just knowing you can walk into any room in the world and generate electricity with some magnets and wire is empowering, literally.
Yeah.
Just got my own pun. Hilarious.
Won't be the last
so,
time.
So, yeah, it's... It was to make everyone better time travelers, or at least better dinner party guests.
Yeah, and I mean better citizens too. Like, there's a definite ethical thing, and there's a controversial agenda that I found myself reacting to as I went through it, because it isn't. I mean, I know people, and we've had as guests at the festival people who think that the Neolithic was basically a mistake, that we would be happier with less fertility, shorter lifespans, a more mobile lifestyle, and like less free time, but like no farming and no written language, and
so like hunting and gathering, going back.
Yeah, like that, and other people who are very, very ambivalent.
I mean, about civilization?
About civilization, yeah. I like it.
I like it, yeah.
It kind of keeps me alive. But the very, like, pro... Like, yeah, writing can be used to enslave humans. Yeah, like, engines can be used to, like, fuck up the atmosphere. Sorry. This is supposed to be all ages. If you let a standards war end up with the wrong kind of engine, you're going to end up with too much carbon in the atmosphere, stuff like that.
Right.
But the way that you put in those warnings in a way that's still largely pro-civilization.
Yeah.
Did you think about that in revision?
Yeah, you don't write a book about how to invent civilization without being pro-civilization.
Yeah. but that's actually a controversial stance now.
I hope it's not. I feel like one of the major ideas in the book is that the most precious resource we have are human brains.
Yeah.
They let you do anything. And so civilization is a way to support and nurture these human brains. And living in a hunter and gathering, in the fabulous hunting and gathering lifestyle, the problem with that, the major problem with that, is that you're always moving around. You're going where food brings you.
Yeah.
And so you're being exposed to all sorts of new diseases. You're eating unfamiliar fruit and vegetables and animals that could be toxic. Like, there's the lifespan of a hunter or gatherer, while it is easier in times of plenty because you don't have to work on a farm, which is great, it's short. You're always exposing yourself to new threats. But once you settle down and, you know, start farming, start a civilization, start producing more food than you need, you have this generosity in civilization.
Yeah,
like, the whole point of having more food is that you can feed other people.
Yeah, you have more control over your own environment and it extends to others. Yeah,
yeah.
Jared Diamond is the name I was looking for, the Guns, Germs, and Steel guy, who at least at one point in his career was saying, you know, like, this whole thing is not going to happen. But no, I'm absolutely with you. And I
pro-civilization.
What?
We're pro-civilization.
We are. And I love how much of this book is devoted to, like, how not to poison yourself.
Yeah, it's really easy. Funny story about that. So part of surviving in the past is just surviving. And so I read all these survivalist guides that different people had written. And there is a lot of bad survivalist guides out there. Just not even self-published stuff. Like, there's the fantasy. This book is, I think, inherently optimistic. Because the idea of going back in time is fixing things, doing it better. Most survival guides are inherently pessimistic. They say the apocalypse is going to happen, and you're going to survive because you have the most guns, and you're going to be great. And this book I was reading was saying, yeah, after the apocalypse, you'll need food, of course. Go into cities and eat tinned food. Ignore expiry dates because food doesn't go bad. It's a government conspiracy that food goes bad.
Wow.
Because think about it, when food goes bad, that's tiny animals eating the food. They're not dying, so the food's still good. And I was like, that doesn't sound right to me.
Was this a commercially published
book? Yeah, it was commercial. So the kicker is, it was like, update to the second edition. I got botulism.
Oh, my God.
So the author concedes that fish can go bad because you got botulism from fish, but other food still doesn't go bad. And it's like, what is this? Who is publishing this? So in my book, food does go bad. But it has a lot of ways to preserve it to help to keep it from going bad as quickly. That's what making cheese is. Cheese is preserved milk, stuff like that.
I love the demystification
and
the way that you do that across the branches of the sciences. Did you feel like writing the parts, like, I don't know what other science background you have, but the CS part, like, feels like a really good CS textbook. Ever passed the CS class, but, like,
right.
I felt like, oh, now I know what a NAND gate is.
Right.
This is someone who just wrote this from memory. And was writing the stuff about, like, mining and material science, did it feel different because you had to learn that?
I thought we were going with the fantasy that was all my giant brain and I had it all.
I mean, that's the question.
Yes. I did do a lot of research, and actually the first year of this was just research. And there's a point, I think, in any project, any large project, where you think, oh, no, I've decided to do something impossible.
Yes, yes.
Once again.
Yes.
And the idea that I'm just going to collapse, you know, everything down into 468 pages started to feel impossible. And if you've written stuff before, if you've gotten through it before, I think you can realize that most of the time, it's not impossible, it's just really hard. And you can work with really hard. You can put the work in for really hard. So I did all this research, and then I finally just basically locked myself in a room and started writing. And
with your dog?
With my dog, Chomsky. And then when we were about, I did the writing. When I was about 50,000 words in, I decided, yes, okay, there's enough. There's A, you can collapse enough useful stuff down that you can build just one person who knows what they're doing. And B, you can, it actually is a viable guide to building a civilization. Because I wanted, as much as I expect most copies will be read in 2018 and forwards. I did want the book to be a legitimate answer to the question of, would this work in the past? Yeah. So I want it to be, to feel sincere, because as soon as you, if I broke that, it sort of ruins the whole premise of the book. Like, it's no longer an actual time travel book, and I want it to be that real time travel guide.
It really feels that way. It really feels, if you want to read the whole thing and treat it as hard science fiction, you can.
Yeah. Oh, hard, yeah, that's right.
I mean, it is. It's
like the hardest science fiction.
It's deep cover. It's like an Alan Gurganis book, except hard SF. Like, it presents itself as nonfiction in a fictional universe, except the fictional universe is SF. And do you have a hard SF background? Or did you, like, want to be Gregory Benford at some point in the past and then realize that you didn't?
I would read the hard SF, and I'd feel like I got some of it. But I remember...
Well, we should define hard SF for people here, shouldn't we?
So hard science fiction, you probably have better...
Hard science fiction isn't actually more difficult than other science fiction, except when it's, like, badly written, which happens. Hard science fiction is science fiction that really sets out to be as close to what we know about the natural sciences and the quantitative sciences as it can be, and to, at best, educate its readers about those things as you follow the plot.
So up the science, lower the fiction.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. But, I mean, lower the fiction is only if it's bad.
Yeah. I mean, I would read that, and I feel like I'm pretty smart. Okay. I used to read, I still do, I read a bunch of Isaac Asimov, which I think was, the thing with Isaac Asimov's stories is that he's 100% plot. His characters are paper thin. I would love that. I would gobble that up. And then I start to write and be like, why can't I write good characters? All I love is plot.
That's a common experience.
Yeah.
It's plot and information.
Yeah.
Because he's a really good nonfiction writer.
Yep.
And was actually, I didn't realize that. I think, like, I doubt we're exactly the same age, but did you grow up reading the, like, 5 billion Asimov nonfiction books? Like, Asimov on Chemistry, Asimov on Numbers?
No, I haven't read any of them.
Oh. Okay.
It sounds great.
it's just someone who's a very good popular nonfiction writer explaining to you, like, why imaginary numbers exist,
right,
or, like, what condensation is. Was there a model in terms of prose style or a model for the kind of book you were writing?
No, I mean, a little bit of Hitchhiker's Guide, where the idea of here is a nonfiction thing about an absurd subject.
Yeah.
One of the things that sort of modeled it as I was writing is I went into this not expecting to find all these moments in history in which we could have invented something and didn't. And there's tons.
Yeah, I, like, found myself highlighting them. let me find one. I mean, go on.
Talk. Well, sure. One of the easy examples is the compass, which we all get how it works. It's a little magnet balanced on a pin. Magnet points towards magnetic north, and there's your compass. But those were invented in around 1000 CE in China, and they were first used for fortune-telling and ended up being navigation 100 years later. But we could have invented them in 200 BCE. That's when the ancient Greeks first noticed that some rocks stick together, and they were playing with magnets. And the crazy thing is, to invent a compass, once you have the magnet, all you have to do is allow that rock to rotate freely so it points towards north. And
put it in water or something.
You can just tie it to a string. To invent the compass, all you have to do is tie a rock to a string, and it took us over 1,000 years. And I felt kind of bad for us, because I kept seeing examples where this would happen. Pasteurization is another great one.
Stethoscopes.
Stethoscope story.
Do you want to read this?
It's all in the vault. What did I say?
You said great things.
Yeah. So I'll do the quick story of the stethoscope, which I'm not sure I put it all in there, actually. Okay. Stethoscope gets invented in, 1816 CE, and it gets invented because there's this doctor, a heterosexual man, who has a busty female patient, and he wants to listen to her heart, but he can't put his ear there because it's too erotically charged an experience for him. And so he rolls up a tube of paper to leave some room for Jesus and listens through the tube and discovers by accident that this isolates and enhances the sound of her heart that he's trying to hear. And it's one of the few instances I could find of actual scientific progress being made by someone being too horny to do their job properly. But that stethoscope, that was just a rolled up piece of paper. Like, you don't need the fancy plastic metal we have now. You can just roll up a tube of paper. And we had paper since 300 BCE. Like, that's another thing where the stethoscope led to us realizing that diseases are a collection of symptoms and different organs can behave in different ways, and that can be diagnostic, what are diseases. All this medical progress was made because of the stethoscope, and we had to wait until, like, Dr. Horny.
Well, you know, I think another way to tell that story is that the progress gets made because it took that long for a heterosexual man to discover appropriate professional boundaries.
That's true. But yeah,
now we know about professional boundaries, and we have better biochemistry.
And we have better technology. But it's just these gaps, these huge gaps of time where he could have invented something and didn't. And doing that, I felt like, oh, I feel bad for you guys. But when I finished the book, I realized there's sort of an optimistic spin on this, where there's all these moments in history in which we had everything we needed to invent something and couldn't actually invent that thing because we just didn't put the parts together in the right way. It stands to reason there's probably something like that right now that could be invented and no one's managed to do it yet. And I think that's great, like feeling there's still low-hanging fruit, still stuff that we can put together, I think is really interesting.
Can we talk? I want to talk about water computers and CS.
Yes.
Because water computers are amazing. And then I think we should probably talk about, like, Koi Boy.
Sure.
So at the end of this book, it turns out that once you know the principles of CS, you don't even need electricity.
You can build computational machinery out of water, yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy. It's this thing where we invent electronic computers, and we start to notice that there's ways to make logic gates out of all sorts of stuff. And
what is a logic gate?
A logic gate is, how do we start the beginning? So if you want to add some numbers, you need to have basic operations. One of them's AND, one of them's OR. And you just sort of define them. 1 or 0, we'll say that's 1, because there's a 1 there. 1 and 1 will also be 1. 1 and 0 will be 0. It's just basically saying, here's how these basic numbers, 1 and 0, can combine in different ways. And a gate is any piece of machinery that combines it for you. So a NOT operation turns a 1 into a 0, or a 0 into a 1. And a very simple NOT gate is you just take a pulley, so a rope with a pulley up here, goes over like this, and if I pull this pulley down, the other side goes up. So if I define up as being 1 and low as being 0, a 1 becomes a 0 and a 0 becomes a 1. So it's a gate out of a pulley. And you can actually do mathematics with a properly arranged series of pulleys. Or with water, with a properly set up gate, you can have exclusive OR, which is another operation, and a NAND coming out. It gets complicated in the details, but the high idea is just by moving physical objects in the right way, you can reproduce the operations you need to run a computer, which is crazy. Like we think of computers as being these really complicated black boxes, and you can duplicate part of it with a pulley, just pulling a string.
Steampunk.
It's pretty big.
So this is a wonderful book, and you should all buy it in case you get stuck in the past or the future.
Mm-hmm.
And you can restart civilization, which I am absolutely in favor of. You can cure diseases and write things down. But also, I hope that in the future there will be more issues of Squirrel Girl, which...
I love that you brought your issues with you. That's
Didn't bring
that
them
one
all.
Just came out this week.
A couple of these are not
brand
Squirrel
new.
Girl, sorry. I'm going to segregate and remove the non-Squirrel Girl, which are also good things. Yes, it is brand new.
Yeah. Put a picture of me in the letters page.
Yeah. I never did your hair color before that.
Yeah.
Does anyone here not know about Squirrel Girl? Oh, wow. Okay, we got to do some Dorian 101.
All right, let me give you the pitch. Squirrel Girl is a woman with all the powers of a girl and all the powers of a squirrel. She fights crime. She eats nuts and kicks butts.
So good, people. It's so
good. The thing that distinguishes her from most superheroes is that probably like all of us here, when we have a conflict, we try to talk about it before we get into a fist fight rather than afterwards. The superhero model is first you fight each other, and then you say, wait a minute, we're best friends. How could we forget? Because it makes for good comics. You get to see Iron Man and Captain America fight. But in real life, you tend
to... Good example.
Yeah. In real life, you tend to talk about it first. And so Squirrel Girl's thing is she's empathic. She tries to listen to people. And, you know, she still gets into superhero fights. But, for example, she saved Earth from Galactus, a planet-eating god monster from the depths of space.
With a purple hat.
With a cool tuning fork hat. By just talking to him and figuring out what he wants and befriending him. And It's a fun comic to write because I get to do stuff that I never thought I'd get to do in a superhero context.
Yeah, and you've... All of the comics that you've written have been... And that are long-form narrative comics, rather than like dinosaur comics, have had some kind of all-ages, like, let's not have a fight component, I think, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, my secret... here is the secret to writing all ages comics. I will share it with you. I don't believe you should talk down to children. I think they're very smart.
Yeah.
And so the secret to all ages comics that the rules I work by is you just write regular comics, except everyone keeps their clothes on and nobody swears. And if you can hold that down, then you can produce an all ages comic.
Yeah, and an alternate universe in which real historical figures don't square, like the new Death of Squirrel Girl, you're in the middle of a story. This probably shouldn't be the first issue you pick up. You can just pick up the first trade paperback, which has the Galactus story in it, which is one of the great introductions to Squirrel Girl. But in this one, there's a character called Brain Drain, who goes by Brian normally, who's a brain in a jar learning how to be human, which many of us have had that experience, who quotes PG-13 Jean-Paul Sartre. Who says things like, heck is other people.
Heck is other people, yeah. I love Brain Drain. He is a character I just sort of took what was there and reinvented him something new. But Squirrel Girl is a very positive character. She's optimistic. She's lots of fun. And then she hangs out with this nihilistic brain in a jar. And they click so well. I didn't expect them to click that well, but I just love Brain Drain. Brian Drain. When he's incognito, he puts oven mitts over his robot hands. So no one can tell each other. And a hat, yeah. And he always passes.
Yeah, look, if we do this if we do this again, we're going to have a slideshow.
Yeah.
So Squirrel Girl has life lessons that you can actually use if you're, I'm 47, if you're 47 or 7, about how to handle conflict. It's also full of actual CS lessons because Doreen and her non-superpowered best friend are computer science majors at
ESU, Empire State University.
Yes.
So yeah, the thing with that is when I was first pitching Squirrel Girl to Marvel, I initially had her as a computer science student. Then I thought, I know computer science, this is probably too easy. I'll just make her an English major, and that way it'll be harder for me to write. And my wife was like, why are you doing this thing? It's easy for you. And also, like, you get to have a representation of a woman in a STEM field. And I was like, oh yeah, that is a good idea.
And there's actually, like, CS lessons embedded in it. If you need an English major for Squirrel Girl, like, we can help you.
No, CS is great. And the thing I love about, because one of the reasons I made her a computer science major was that I really don't like comic book computer science where it's like, let's hack into the Pentagon, I'm past their firewall, I'll make a GUI in Visual Basic and we'll punch through their OS layer. And it's like, what? You're just making up words. And it's nice to have, computer science save the day, but it is as much as possible legitimate computer science. Like, she's just good at what she does. And I feel like that's very achievable. Like,
Is she the best there is? Because so she's very nice.
Wolverine has a slogan, I'm the best at what there is, I'm best at what I do, but what I do isn't very nice. And I should steal that for Squirrel Girl. I'm the best at what I do, and what I do is pretty okay. Like, it's fine. What I do is fine.
I'll be so happy if that shows up in a future issue. And you had, like, Erica Henderson, who is not here because she's possibly at home drawing, who is a Boston area artist who's terrific.
She drew the first 35 issues.
Yeah, invented the visual style, and it's so right for these characters. You made a transition to working with a new artist, and I feel like I have to ask about that.
Yeah. Derek Charm and I had worked before on Jughead together, so it was very easy to sort of switch into that.
What is Junkman?
Jughead,
I'm sorry.
He's a burger-loving teen.
I'm sorry. I keep forgetting to ask you about Archie's. Should I ask you about Archie's?
Sure.
Okay. Do you want to talk about... Because many people in here, especially people who were, like, over... Who were old enough to...
Well, there's the CW show now. Everyone knows Jughead.
Right. Know about Archie Comics, but don't know about Archie Comics now. Like, do you want to say what that is?
Yeah, I mean, it was Archie's... When I say Archie, I mean the company. It's very easy to confuse him with the character. We'd be like, oh, Archie's paying me late. And it's like, is he busy with Veronica? What's the delay? But Archie, the company, was getting into doing actual comic books that they hadn't really done before at full size. And so my buddy Chip did the first 8 issues of Jughead, and then me and Derek took over to do the last 6 or 7 issues of Jughead. And it was tons of fun. They asked for, like, what's your hot new take on Jughead? Give us your fresh new Jughead. I'm like, Jughead's fine. He's a teen who likes to eat burgers and is afraid to talk to women, and that's very easy to relate to. So I just did classic Jughead stories, and it was a lot of fun. And since Derek and I had that relationship already, we could launch into Squirrel Girl very quickly. My main criteria for Derek that I want to make sure he would nail is that when Craven shows up in our first issue of Squirrel Girl, and the feedback we got was like, wow, Craven's a good-looking man now, sexy Craven. And Eric was like, I always thought he was sexy. He has this open vest with his, like, a lion vest, and his chest hair is there. So my directions to Derek were, let's keep Craven, like, let's keep hot Craven. And he was like, not a problem.
Craven was one of the bad guys who was convinced to not be bad so much.
Yeah, a thing Squirrel Girl does often is sort of try to help the villains with their underlying issues. And that's hard in real life and also hard in comics because comics always tends to return to the status quo. Like if somebody dies, they'll probably come back to life. And so changing a character, redeeming a character like Craven, we've been sort of doing it since our first issue and just finished an arc in which sort of brought that to the conclusion we could. And you always hope that'll stay. Comics continuity is very weird, but you hope that the way it works normally is that if a story is popular enough, that sort of gets folded into what we all believe is the history of that character. So there's been an unbroken chain of Batman stories since the 40s, I think, or the 30s? When did Batman come out? 40s.
And I think it's 1940.
Yeah. So a history of unbroken series of Batman stories, but the ones we remember are the best ones, and those sort of are his official history. And so your goal, your hope as a writer in comics, in mainstream superhero comics, is to write something that gets folded into that character's history.
Yeah, yeah. That's also the way real life works, right? Like, a lot of stuff happens to you, but you remember the ones that change you the most, and that's a way of seeing what changed you the most is what you remember.
And the bad stuff, you just declare non-canon and forget about it. Never Ooh. Happened.
I have a lot of feelings. I'm not going to go there. I do want to ask one more Squirrel Girl question,
sure.
though, which is one of the things that makes Squirrel Girl so good, one of the things that distinguishes it from other terrific all-ages comics that are going on now, like Lumberjanes, is that it interacts with the entire Marvel Universe.
Mm-hmm.
That it is... At least, Squirrel Girl exists in the same universe in which, like, Iron Man and Captain America keep arguing about the Constitution and, like, having punching fights. And superhero weddings get called off or called on, and, people on surfboards go in space. And Squirrel Girl is constantly interacting with ways... This is Squirrel Girl. She's not really dead, but...
Spoilers.
Someone who looks like her has just died, and this is various superheroes showing up at Squirrel Girl's funeral and lamenting her in character. And there's so many in-jokes if you know who all these people are, and if you don't, you can be introduced to them. Like Deadpool is trying to make a buck by selling trading cards, and Laura Kinney, who is one of the Wolverines, has an actual Wolverine that's another Wolverine. Did Doreen give her...
She did,
Jonathan?
Yeah. She showed up at Wolverine's apartment, and she's like, I have something to tell you. I think it would come better from a Wolverine. And Wolverine was like, I don't talk to Wolverines. That's not one of my superpowers. And Doreen was like, oh, I did not realize that. Because she assumes she's Squirrel Girl. She can talk to squirrels. Clearly,
right.
Wolverine can talk to Wolverines.
Right.
She keeps making that mistake. There's all these animal-themed heroes and villains that do not talk to those animals.
Yeah. That was an issue of All New Wolverine, right?
Yeah. But it's the thing with that is before I started writing Squirrel Girl, I read everything I could about her. And there was one scholarly essay written about her. And it was making the point that
about
Squirrel Girl.
I've read it.
Yeah. It's great. It was making the point that, this is before I started writing her, but up to this point, the more powerful Squirrel Girl got, the more she defeated, high-tier beings, the more her adventures became kind of break the fourth wall, a little bit winky. And it was making the argument that this is a way to take this female power and say, well, that doesn't really count. These aren't the real stories. These are just fun what-if stories, but her victories aren't real. And I was like, no, like, I want her victories to be real. And so...
Yeah.
This is why I do so much work to keep her situated in the actual Marvel Universe, because these are real victories, these are real stories, there's nothing fake about them. And as much as, I say real, as much as a Spider-Man story is real, so is a Squirrel Girl story.
Yeah, are there Galaxy Quest fans in here? Do you know the movie? Yeah, it's real. It's all real. I guess that answers my question about, like, how and why you keep these all-ages fun stories connected to the very tonally different
Yeah, it's weird because they're all taking place in the same universe. But the Marvel Universe is a crazy place. I don't know why anyone would live in New York City because it's constantly being invaded by aliens. Like, there was an event a couple years ago in which everyone in New York City got Spider-Man powers. I was like, why would you live here? Like, you're just going to work and suddenly you're sticking to walls. It's a huge hassle. But
for the adventure.
For the adventure, sure, sure.
It's also possible that, like, Minneapolis and St. Paul are also constantly invaded by aliens, but they don't have people to fight back.
Maybe.
They're fine. That's a bad example. D.C., certainly. I'm from D.C., I can say that.
But the reason... I forgot what I was going to say. I had a good answer for a question.
I'm gonna ask you the last Marvel Universe question, and then we're going to go back to your new amazing book about time travel.
Sure.
So, as you can imagine, like, there's the devoted fan base that is young and has amazing... Pretty much every issue, if you look at the back, there's kids and adults dressing up as Skrull Girl. Like, the source of cosplay, including cosplay that is legit for people who are, like, 6 or 10, it's unrivaled. But there's also, like, the adults who are reading Skrull Girl are often reading other Marvel books and really love what you've just said you were doing on purpose. Mm-hmm. And it changes the tonality of the characters, who are often very serious, violent characters that Skrull Girl interacts with, and makes them better and happier. So is she going to meet Gabby again?
I'd like her to. I sort of discussed with my editor bringing other characters into Skrull Girl's corner of the Marvel Universe, where it's all in the same world, but whenever a different writer is writing character, it changes a little bit, and you sort of discuss, like, how does this character interact with Skrull Girl? What is it like with, Kraven and Skrull Girl, or the Punisher and Skrull Girl? Like, how do they interact? And it's a lot of fun. It's almost like a puzzle, like a chess game or something, where you're trying to figure out if these pieces can even click together, and you find the right angle where they go and click. It's sort of the fun of writing in a shared universe. Yeah. Is the rules are always changing, the characters are always changing. We had one story where it's one where she went to space and sort of got into a fight with the Silver Surfer, and I was going to have her team up with Doctor Strange, and my editor said, you can, but just so you know, right now Loki is Doctor Strange. He's Sorcerer Supreme. And I was like, that's great, I love Loki so much more, let's do him instead. And it was this nice sort of thing where it just happened to work out that way. Yeah. Sometimes we had one where early on she beats up the Avengers in 26 seconds. And so I said, hey, I want her to beat up Captain America. And Mander said, well, we'll have to check with the Captain America office.
Yeah.
And I sort of picture, like, Captain America sitting behind a desk.
Yeah.
And so the Cap office comes back and they're like, yeah, you can use him, but just so you know, right now he's had the super soldier serum sucked out of him, so he's an old man with no powers. And I was like... Squirrel Girl beating up an old man with no powers feels malicious in a way it didn't with Captain America, so I said, well, let's not have her beat him up. And then my editor's editor hopped in the email chain. He was like, well, actually, Cap is a trained military man in peak physical condition, even at 86 years old, and he could easily, and I was like, fine, she'll beat him up. Like, so I had her beat him up, and the cover to that issue has all the Avengers coming down from the right corner, and Squirrel Girl on the bottom left, their dukes up. And we ended up trimming that because the initial draft had her like that, but behind her was the knocked out Captain America. But just read as, like, she beat up a senior.
Yeah.
And now she's justifiably being attacked. So it's...
Trying to see if we have that issue here. We don't.
Yeah.
We do have a lot of these covers. This is one that I've heard Erica talk about that's an homage to a 70s Avengers cover, right?
Yep.
How much input do you have when you work with Derek? On how the book looks. Is it full script?
I write a full script. Sometimes I'll give suggestions for the cover, but usually they have better ideas than I do, so I'm just like, run with it, surprise me.
They're artists. Yeah.
They're artists, yeah. They think visually. So they're much better at doing the visual aspect than I am. So I just say, on this page, there's 6 panels. Here's the description of what's happening. Here's the 6 panels. I've started, as I get more familiar with the artists, to put in little jokes for them or just quick asides, like, because I realize this is sort of the secret of comics, is when you're writing a script, you're not writing it for the reader, you're not writing it for the editor, you're writing it for no one but the artist. And your job is to make a script that's so cool that the artist will want to draw it. Because the reality is, it takes you as the writer 10 seconds to say, on this page, Doreen fights 1,000 ninjas. That's going to take all day to draw. And so you want to make it worthwhile. You want to make it interesting. And so I've had scripts described as love letters to the artist.
Yeah.
And I sort of write it that way, both for Erica and Derek, where I'm like, this is me and you having a conversation, and here's what I think we should do, but throw in whatever you want, mix it up, add some panels, change the pacings. It's very collaborative. It's what I love about a collaborative medium, especially in comics, because people assume that everything that's written on the page came out of my hand, my pen. Yeah. And it's not the case, but I get the credit for it. Yeah. So it's a great medium to work in if you like getting the credit from your artistic collaborator.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's fine.
No. It's a visual medium. It's a collaborative medium. Gabby could really use a visit from Dorit right now.
She could.
She could make that happen.
It's been some rough times.
I know a lot of people who will be very happy. Let me take you back to graduate school, but not leave you there, because that would be horrible. Does the Ryan North, who's like in grad school in CS, know that writing comics and explaining how to rebuild all of civilization is stuff, and writing Choose Your Own Adventure novels, which Ryan also does he know that stuff that he's going to do, or does he want to, like, mostly code and design, or what does he want to do, and how does he turn into you?
So the question is how to invent everything.
Oh, that's even more meta than I thought it would be, yeah.
So I started Dinosaur Comics, started writing creatively in undergrad, my last year of undergrad, and I kept it up all through grad school.
Dinosaur Comics is a web comic.
It's the first sort of writing I really did. Yeah. I kept that up through grad school, and then when I graduated, I had this choice of do I get a real job and use this degree that costs all this money, or do I do comics? And I was already doing comics, so to continue doing comics, all I had to do was fail to get a job, which is so easy. Didn't even apply anywhere. And that's how I became a full-time cartoonist, by just failing to get a job. And after a couple years of that, I sort of decided, yeah, this is sustainable. I can do this and still keep up my fabulous student lifestyle of macaroni and cheese for lunch and stuff. And I think it was really useful. Dinosaur Comics, it's the same six panels, different words. It's always the same three dinosaurs and six panels. And doing that for 15 years, if nothing else, it at least taught me how to write a conversation, because the comic is all conversation. And so I feel like when I get stuck writing Squirrel Girl, I'll just start making them have a conversation and then try to work that into a fight scene, something that's more visually interesting. But it's, as much as all the things I do are different, I've done Choose Your Adventures, Dinosaur Comics, Squirrel Girl, all this crazy stuff, nonfiction time travel now, which I want there to be a new section of the library called Nonfiction Time Travel. I'm like, that's me. My book.
Yeah.
The only thing there. It all sort of helps you as you go. And I feel like, in terms of education, I'm not using my master's in computational linguistics much, but it does inform other stuff. You know, you learn how to learn. And there is a panel in the graphic novel Unbeatable Squirrel Girl Beats Up the Marvel Universe where they're in class. And if you look at their laptop screen, there is an answer to an assignment I wrote in grad school on their screen. I was like, there, it was useful. It's a consensus problem in distributed computing.
We got to take some questions from people who aren't you or me.
Let's do it.
Are we wired? If we're not wired, I can move around, call on... Ooh! Bright light. I can move around, call on people, and then I'm going to repeat your question since this is being recorded and I'm mic'd up and you're not. Questions? The back first. Hi.
Hi.
Oh. Well, no, you can just stand there and ask your question. I'll repeat it.
Okay. So my question is for Ryan. One thing that's really interesting about your Squirrel Girl comics is kind of the way that you play with, like, the blank space, the gutter in the comics. So I was just wondering, like, where you got that idea to, you know, add, extra running commentary.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. The question is where Ryan got the idea to have a running commentary or extra text at the bottom of most pages of Squirrel Girl.
Yeah. So that comes from Dinosaur Comics, where if you hold your mouse over the comic, a little secondary punchline comes up. But I like it in Squirrel Girl because comics is a not inexpensive hobby. And I like the fact that we're trying to, you know, get you your money's worth by literally cramming jokes into the margins. And it also performs a structural role, because sometimes I'll get a note from my editor saying, you know, you should explain that Captain America has had the super soldier serum sucked out of him. And instead of having someone say, as you know, Squirrel Girl, Captain America has had blah, 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 I can just put that at the bottom of the page in the form of a joke, and it's such an efficient way to get things done. It's like, I've met my editor's note, everyone knows what they need to know, and we can move forward. The only downside is that I get emails from people my age and older who are like, my eyesight is not what it used to be, and this is very small, very, very small text, and I apologize for that. Yeah.
Your hand is up.
Okay.
Which explains why I didn't.
Oh, I'm so sorry. No. Hi.
I just want to say, so my husband reads me comics. He's like this uber comic fanboy.
Well, he sounds great.
And we have this phrase called Red Kryptonite, where he gets to just completely geek out and tell me about all the little in jokes. And your comics have provided just so many hours of opportunity for conversation for us. So. There are lots of comics that we start to read, and I'll just be like, that's not really very interesting. But Squirrel Girl never fails us, so I just wanted to say, you know, thank you.
Thank you. It's Squirrel Girl is a very dialogue-heavy comic. I apologize a lot to my letterers. but I never thought for someone who can't see the page, that would be a really good plus, right? Because there's more to consume that way.
Yeah, and there's so much going on with the relationships.
Yes.
Like, we just finished the one with Squirrel Girl and Nancy being, like, stuck
in
fast time.
Yeah.
And
oh, I love that one.
Yeah, and it was just lots of, oh, they're such great friends. And, like, you know, you could definitely do a slash fiction about that one. And so.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yay.
Hi. Wait, were you? I saw your hand first.
I had a quick question about having been everything going back to what you were saying about, oh, there can be this big gap of time between when something could be invented. But what about the case of, like, is there sort of a how to invent the Enlightenment or how to invent that people will listen to you? Because there was a case of, like, the doctor who came up with, hey, you should wash your hands before you do surgery, and people just laughed at him. And it was, like, another 100 years before anyone started washing their hands before surgery. Or you could be burned as a witch. It could be even worse.
Yeah. He actually died in an insane asylum from injuries, an infected injury he got when he was beat up by the guards. So it gets even more ironic. And then we discover what germs are 30 years later, and like, oh, we should have listened to him. Whoops. So one of the points I make in the book is this, the greatest gap we have the most effect on history is between 200,000 BCE and 50,000 BCE. And 200,000 BCE is when you have anatomically modern humans first show up, so those are humans who look like us, bodies like ours. And 50,000 is where you have behaviorally modern humans show up. These are humans who decorate their bodies with art and bury their dead and start behaving more like we do. And there's this huge gap of 150,000 years. What changed? One of the theories is that in that time we invented language, which is technology like anything else, and we started to talk to each other, which, you know, lets ideas survive the death of the host, underlines that other humans have the same interior life that you do and sort of beginnings of who we are.
Yeah.
So if you want to go have the biggest effect in history, you can go back and teach these early humans how to talk, how to speak, how to write, before they do it on their own. Because it's very hard to invent your own. If you want to invent language, you have to be the caveman genius who both invents it and can teach it to somebody else. And it turns out that teaching language is really, really hard. If you haven't learned a first language after puberty, you probably never will. It's very hard to pick up a language you don't learn as a baby. So all this to say, my advice is to kidnap cave babies and teach them.
Yeah. You say start with children.
Start with children. Or if you're not going to kidnap them, befriend their parents and talk to the children, because you'll be able to, within, you know, 12 years, have humans who are speaking your language and who will much more likely have a rapport with than otherwise. If you show up where there's already humans and they're suspicious, you could just start your own competing civilization that has antibiotics, soap, and beer, and maybe draw some in that way.
Yeah. Those are good mentions. How many more questions can we take?
Is anyone counting the number of knocks?
What did that mean? Was that Morse code? We can take a couple more, right?
Yeah, we got time for questions.
Yeah. Hi.
Two things. I wanted to point out that the idea of kidnapping babies from the cave people, that was The Ugly Little Boy by Isaac Asimov. That was a part of that
story.
Yeah,
there you go, yeah.
The other is I teach computer science, and specifically C++, at WPI, and I've used Squirrel Girl in my courses.
Oh, that's awesome.
Talking about how she uses ASCII and loops, and also the fact that she was able to defeat Dr. Doom because his entire programming language is variants of the word doom.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun to write. I don't think anyone, my editors aren't really up on their computer science, so I can slip stuff in and get away with it, which is always nice.
Thinking about creative restrictions, you know, Dinosaur Comic, you mentioned, is the same three dinosaurs in six panels every time.
Yep.
Was that useful to you when you were getting started writing, having that same framework? And I notice you're drawn to projects like this. Well, here's a very wonderful premise, and it's very constrained. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a survival guide to time travelers, or I'm going to take William Shakespeare and do a choose-your-own-adventure novel out of it. And you seem like, on some level, I'm going to have a frame in which to operate. Are you drawn to projects like that, and is it very different than, well, here's somebody with squirrel powers and 100 years of comics continuity, go.
100?
Well,
yeah.
You know,
it's
order N.
Yeah, it's, I do. A thing I love about Dinosaur Comics is that I'm never facing a blank sheet of paper. I've always got, you know, T-Rex is probably going to be in tomorrow's Dinosaur Comic because he's there in every panel.
Probably. I'm scared now.
The funny thing, sort of the funny side story about that, is I was asked once by my old campus newspaper, where do you get your ideas for Dinosaur Comics? I said, oh, well, you know, I never face a blank sheet of paper, but if I get stuck, I have this giant text file of, you know, snippets of dialogue or ideas I'd like to explore. So even though I'm never facing a blank sheet of paper with the comic itself, I have this other text file that helps me if I ever get writer's block. And the person sort of said, uh-huh, interesting, and took notes. And then it reached print and online as not I have a giant text file, but that I have a giant textile, like a rug.
Oh.
That I look at when I get stuck. And it's such a better explanation that it's now the official canon. But yeah, I feel like when you have, I guess it's a high concept, you have something that you're working towards building that's so specific, I find that really useful. I've never written, like I said, a straight novel because it feels so open and amorphous, and I'm not sure where even to start. But knowing, you know, a time travel guide, then I know I should at least start with research and see where that takes me. Like, it gives me a framework to work in. So I'm a big fan of, you know, frameworks or restrictions, whatever you want to call it, where at least you have some points on the map that you can move towards rather than just saying, like, I can do anything, so I won't do anything because I don't know what to do.
Constraints generate creativity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think we can take...
Last question.
One more? One more.
This is an incredibly stupid question, but since everybody else seems to be done, I'm going to ask it anyway. I'm about 40 pages into How to Invent Everything, loving it, of course. There's one little throwaway detail that caught my attention for some reason, and I can't resist asking about it. The time machines are constrained to go no more than 1.5 seconds into the future. Why 1.5?
So that is I put that restriction in to not go too far in the future because I figure once you invent time machines, you've kind of invented utopia, right? Because any problem you have, you just go to the future, see how they solved it, take that idea back with you. The same premise of the book, but moving forward. So you're just stealing ideas from the future. So everything should be solved by then. And so by having that 1.5 restriction it made, I didn't have to write too much about what that utopia is like because it got very complicated. But as for like why 1.5 and why not 1.25 or something like that, I felt like it was a kind of number that seemed specific enough. You know when you see rules where there's a rule that's like, you know, don't pet the kangaroos, and like someone clearly petted a kangaroo and made this rule happen? I felt like 1.5, like clearly something happened at like 1.25 or something, 1.75 that made them be like, this is the line, this far, no further.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of work, a lot of weight to put on a single number, but that was my reasoning behind it. Excellent, thank you.
So thanks to the book festival and to everybody who brought Ryan here and to you and to Doreen and Nancy and their friends in the Marvel Universe and to the inventors of the FC-3000 time machine for which we assume no legal liability if it breaks stranding you in the past. If that should happen, you should clearly bring with you a copy of How to Invent Everything, which is fortunately sold separately. You can't buy the FC-3000 here, but you can buy the book, How to Invent Everything, thing, and if you buy it, Ryan will sign it. Whereas if you don't own it or bring Ryan a copy, he will not sign it. Was that an OR gate?
Yes.
Okay.
A needlessly complicated one.
Well, I haven't taken any CS classes, so of course I don't know how to do this. But Ryan does buy the book, How to Invent Everything. It's right up there, right?
And we'll be around the corner signing. We'll sign whatever
yes.
you bring.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.